Welcome, everyone, to the Spiritual Brew Pub. I'm your host, Michael Camp. Today, I'm excited to have Kathy Shahada back with us on the podcast. Kathy is a writer, editor, and researcher at If Americans Knew, which is a media organization focused on the Middle East. And she's also a progressive Christian blogger at Pathos with the title Grace Colored Glasses. Kathy, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. You have a particular expertise that we tapped the last time you were on. And, you know, you work for this organization called If Americans Knew, which I'm reading from their website now. So correct me if I'm wrong. They focus on Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The conflict and U.S. foreign policy regarding the Middle East and press coverage of the issue, specifically information that is to a large degree missing from the American media. So last time, 2 months ago, we talked about what people of faith need to know about Israel and Gaza. And if you haven't listened to that one, folks, please do. It is very eye-opening. I also want to say that both Kathy and I, what I call both and activists, that's a phrase I actually got from a Jewish rabbi living in Israel. By that, I mean people who sympathize with anyone, any people who are suffering, in this case, in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, both Israelis and Palestinians, and that's not always equal suffering, as we'll probably learn, but because there is grave suffering on both sides. But Kathy, you have a deep connection to this region as you have family and relatives who are Palestinians living in Gaza, and that's what we want to talk about today, what we're calling a refugee family's quest for survival in Gaza. So today we want to hear about what's going on in Israel from their perspective. And so why don't we get started? Why don't you let us know about your family, introduce us to who they are and where they live, et cetera.
Okay. So first I would just like to put an asterisk on your comment that we're talking about Israel, because Gaza is not part of Israel.
It's right. That's the occupied territories, right?
Palestinian territories.
Right.
And I have been focusing a lot on Gaza because we do have family there. So my husband was born in Gaza in a refugee camp. His parents were part of the Nakba, the catastrophe in 1948, in which about 750,000 Palestinians were exiled from their ancestral homes in Palestine when the state of Israel was created. They were either chased out or ran out and were never allowed to return, which is a violation of international law. So they ended up in Gaza. He was born in Gaza, and we have lots of
relatives. Okay, so they came to Gaza before he was born as refugees, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we've got a number of, Palestinians multiply like rabbits, and there's just oodles of relatives there. Some are close, some are distant, but this family that we've been in touch with are the, so the matriarch of their family is the sister of my father-in-law. So in Palestinian parlance, you would say that's a pretty close relative.
Right.
She's in her 90s. So she was
really a
young mother when the Nakba happened, and she fled, and all of her family, our family, fled, and most of them ended up in Gaza. Some ended up in the West Bank. Zahia is her name. She ended up in the Nusayrat refugee camp, and they were still there until like 2 weeks ago in the refugee camp. So, um, So yeah, she is there with her son and his wife, and they have 8 children, mm-hmm. or maybe 9. I kind of lost track, but they have a whole bunch of children from about, I think about 5th grade through adults,
right.
That are living in the household. So a couple of weeks ago, it was actually on Christmas Eve, I think they got the word to evacuate the camp. And they are now in Khan Yunis, which is a little farther south, and staying with relatives there.
Okay. So how big was this refugee camp they were living in?
That's a good question. Tens of thousands.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know the exact number, but.
Right. So they, when let's get an idea of what this is like, they've been driven out of their homes in 1948, mm-hmm. Flee to either the West Bank or Gaza. In this case, most of the family fled to Gaza. And then they were in a refugee camp. So there was no room for them when they arrived in Gaza. There was already populated with people. So they just opened up refugee camps because there was tens of thousands of people. Right, I mean, you said a total of 750,000. Do you know how many of those arrived in Gaza?
I want to say that about 80% of the residents of Gaza are refugees from 1948, okay. or the families of refugees.
Right.
So I'm not sure exactly how many left. Also, some of the refugees ended up in Lebanon and Jordan and Syria as well. So.
Right. Okay. So it wasn't just in that area. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, well, let's just go back. I mean, what is it like? What was it like for them to live in Gaza? You know, through the years, and then what happened in 2007? Something big happened there. Yeah. But what was it like up until then? And then what happened?
So before 2007, I mean, there's a couple of sections of history. We've got before 1967. 1967 was the Six-Day War, when Israel occupied Gaza. Starting then, there was a lot of restrictions on the people. There was a lot of resistance on the part of Palestinian people in Gaza against the occupation. And because of that, there was a lot of pushback, a lot of violence coming back from Israel to try to stop the resistance. In 2005, okay, and so before that, Israel started to move settlers into Gaza. There were a couple thousand settlers living in Gaza, surrounded by, you know, over a million Palestinians who were exiles. And let's just say they didn't get along well. Thousands of Israeli soldiers were there to protect the settlers in Gaza, and it just didn't go well.
So would you say that it's kind of like the same situation in the West Bank now? It's what was happening back then.
Yeah, it's similar. So in 2005, Israel pulled all of their settlers out of Gaza, and they said, okay, we're not occupying Gaza anymore, but we're going to control everything that goes into Gaza, everything that comes out of Gaza. We're going to control the air above Gaza. We're going to control the water next to Gaza, and nothing is going to happen without our control. So under international law, they're still occupying Gaza, even though they're not inside. They're occupying it from just beyond the borders.
Right. So they're controlling the flow of goods
and
people have, if they have to leave, if they want to leave Gaza, they have to get permission. How hard is it to leave Gaza?
Really hard. They put restrictions so that if you decide to leave Gaza, you probably will never be able to come back again.
Wow.
I don't know why they do that, because they're kind of trying to get rid of Palestinians. So,
yeah,
I think they would make it easy for you to leave, but that's not the case. So yeah, that's what happened in 2005. And then in about 2006 or early 2007, Palestinians held a free and open elections for representation. The Hamas political party won those elections. Now, Hamas has a background, of course, of suicide attacks that go back a long time. These are part of the resistance. When you have virtually no weapons and no money, and your opponent has one of the biggest militaries in the world, you don't have a whole lot of options if you want to resist. And so the method that they could put together was, I mean, after they tried all the other things, there were some suicide bombings. But Hamas was not all about suicide bombings. They were also a political organization. They're also a human, not humanitarian, but they also take care of civic needs of the people.
Mm-hmm.
They were feeding them, making sure they had enough to eat, keeping order in the neighborhoods and things like that. They were really kind of forced into becoming a political party as well. That wasn't what they really wanted to do, but then they got elected. And so basically Israel said, okay, you had your free and open elections and they were legitimate, but we don't like who won. So we're not going to recognize your government. And we're going to consider it a terrorist organization. And we're putting all of Gaza under a blockade until you get rid of these Hamas people, because they don't like Israel and they don't want to recognize Israel. So Gaza has been under that blockade since about 2007. So that's a really long time.
And the blockade was what you talked about, controlling the borders, what comes in and out. There's no free passage.
Right.
And what kind of effect does the blockade have on the economy?
I mean, it completely destroyed the economy. My niece sent me some information, Horia, about the blockade recently. She did some research. She said, because of the restrictions on materials going into Gaza, 80% of the factories were really closed down because they couldn't get the raw materials to manufacture things. So there was nothing to manufacture. People lost their jobs. There was no goods to sell and to buy. And there was really no money going around. So the blockade really destroyed the economy, destroyed the people. Something like 80% of the people are on humanitarian aid. I mean,
very high unemployment rates.
Yeah, before the war started, it was close to 50% unemployment, I think. And for the young people, it was like 75%.
Right. Okay.
So
what did your family do? I mean, did they get to have jobs or just independently try to make money? What were they doing economically?
They have been getting aid from the United Nations for years. Unfortunately, the dad in the family is not able to work because he's got serious health problems. So they've been living on aid for a long time. We've sent them a little something whenever we've been able to, but other than that, they live in free housing in a refugee camp, or they did until they had to evacuate.
Right.
So there were not that many expenses, but there was also nothing to do except sit around and wait for the day. Yeah.
Weren't people trying to, buy and sell things and have a little.
Yeah. There's a market. There was a market. There were farmers grew produce and sold it. So, it wasn't 2 million people just sitting on their couches.
Right.
But there are very few opportunities, and trying to get ahead or trying to save up for the future is very difficult.
What about school? What kind of schooling was there for the kids there?
So Palestinian education is really, really good. And Palestinians are one of the most highly educated people groups in the world, which seems like that should guarantee success. But if you can't get a job, then what do you do with it? So we have one of our nephews that we're in touch with. He got a degree in pharmacy, and he has been a pharmacist. So
did he go to college?
In Gaza.
Okay.
There's a couple of really excellent universities there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A couple others, other brothers, they've gone to school. They have gotten an education. Our niece Haria has a bachelor's degree, but can't find a job. She's almost finished with her master's degree. And now, I don't know what's going to happen with that. If she's going to even be able to finish and graduate now.
So how do the colleges get good professors and teachers there?
Well, Gazans are very well educated. So lots of Gazan professors, they're able to also, bring in some from outside. Mm-hmm. Lots of red tape, but it can be done.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's very interesting. From what I read, the economy is just in shambles because of the blockade and because of these restrictions if you wanted to set up a business, like for example, let's just say you're farming Gaza and you had a crop and you wanted to sell it outside of Gaza, how would that work?
So Israel controls all the borders. So you pack up your goods in a truck and take it to the crossing, and you wait until the Israeli border guards inspect your stuff and take their time. And, if it's hasn't spoiled yet, then it gets unloaded from your truck and reloaded onto another truck on the other side of the border, and then it goes out from there. Mm-hmm. The people inside Gaza need plenty of food too, so there's a market for produce within Gaza as well.
Right. I imagine there is. I heard there was strawberries is a big. Is a big crop there, and they have more strawberries than they need, and they try to export it. Is that right?
Yeah, I've heard that. It's a very delicate product. It's hard to keep strawberries in good condition while they're sitting in the sun waiting at a border.
Right.
It's a risky business.
Right. Okay. So what about after? Since the blockade, blockade was 2007, mm-hmm. and now it's 2024. But even before, let's just say up to October, which huge changes came, mm-hmm. but up until October 7th, it's been pretty much the same. What's it been like for your family? Has their experience been?
Well, so there's two different sets of answers to that question. One is when there's a war on, and one is when there's not a war on.
Yeah, right. Tell us about that, because there hasn't been a whole, from 2007 to October 7th, 2023, has not all been peaceful.
Not by a long shot.
Not at all.
Yeah. And by the way, I just want to mention that having a country or a people group under blockade like this is collective punishment. And collective punishment is a violation of international law. So,
Right. So, I mean, it's under the guise of, well, you know, you have Hamas there, so we have to have all these restrictions, but, but many more people than Hamas are being punished for this.
Right. Yeah. You can't, I mean, it's just that, well, we'll get into that when we talk about the war, but, using Hamas as an excuse for everything that Israel does, at some point, they're going to have to take responsibility for what they've done that had nothing to do with degrading Hamas.
Yeah, so that's been going on, though, off and on since 2007.
Right, at least, yeah. So, yeah. I mean, we've had, there was a war in 2008. There was a war in 2012, a big one in 2014. And then we had the nonviolent protests in 2018. And then I want to say 2020, 2021, 2022, maybe not 2020 because we were in lockdown. So 21, 22, and earlier in 23, there were escalations where for a couple of days, Israel was just dropping bombs all over the place and killing people, and then it would stop. So Haria tells me, we've been in touch for a long, long time, Haria and me, and she talks like, well, you know, this is kind of the worst war I've been through. She's 26. Wow. And she has been through so many wars that she compares them to each other.
Yes, right. That's amazing.
That's not the way you're supposed to grow up. She told me about how terrifying it was, and how she, when she was little, she would cover her head with a blanket when the bombs were dropping, and it was so loud and so noisy. And now she's, like I say, I think 26, and she's got younger brothers and sisters. And so she tries to comfort them when the bombs are dropping and all the noise is happening. So it's terrifying to go through a war, and it's kind of inexplicable. But in between the wars, it's there's constantly Israeli drones flying overhead, reconnaissance missions. Mm-hmm. There are incursions where Israeli military vehicles come inside and just kind of poke around and do whatever they want to do, which is against the law because it's not their property and they're not occupying, supposedly.
So what do you mean by anything they want to do? What do they do?
Well, not a lot of this is well known, but they'll drive some tanks or some jeeps or something into Gaza and maybe scope some things out, maybe try to take out some Hamas people or dig some piles of dirt for themselves to hide behind when they want to do something later, or just rip up some crops, things like that. And they're also constantly sniping at, if there's a farmer who is farming his land and it's too close to the border, they'll just kill him.
Really?
Shooting at the fishermen out in the Red Sea. They're shooting at them, or they'll take their boats away and their fishing gear and just confiscate it.
If they get too far out, is that what you mean?
So yeah, under international law, or maybe it's the Oslo Accords, there's a certain amount of the Red Sea that is supposed to be accessible to the people of Gaza for their fishing. Mm-hmm. And Israel is always saying, no, you can't go that far out, 20 miles maybe. You can't go that far. We'll let you go 6 miles. And if you go more than 6 miles, then you're on your own.
Right.
And people will go 4 miles out and they'll get.
And they'll still be snapped. Yeah. Right.
And
so it's very arbitrary. You never know. Right. It's safe. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So
I'm curious about the previous wars. You said that, what's her name again?
Horia.
Mm-hmm. She described what it was like, you know, to encounter bombing and everything. How close was she living in that refugee camp during those other wars, and how mm-hmm. close were they to the bombing?
They've lived in the refugee camp the whole time. She never told me exactly how close things were, but I mean, sometimes she would say that the house shook.
Okay.
So some of them were close enough.
Yeah.
Or they could see out the window that what was going on, the explosions and the fires and things like that.
Right.
You know, so Gaza is very
close
small.
Enough to see and feel. And, were they hitting the refugee camp or neighborhood? What were they? What were the targets?
Well, that depends on who you ask. Israel right. will say invariably they are hitting a Hamas operative mm-hmm. target of some kind. But a Hamas operative target to them is there is somebody who works for Hamas. They might be in, a mailman, or they might be somebody who passes out food, but he works for Hamas. And he is sleeping at home with his family and, you know, his 10 kids or something. Israel calls that a legitimate target. And they will drop a bomb on that house and kill the whole family. This is against international law. This is not how you conduct these kinds of things.
Yeah, it's really insane. I mean, you know, the Hamas is not like a military. They have a military arm, but they're much more than that.
Right.
And their military arm or the organization itself, they don't have like, you know, army bases or military bases that are targets. I assume that they're just living in the communities where
they have the training areas and things
training
where
areas.
they do things. They gather and do these things, and they have places where they manufacture ammunition and all those kinds of things. But it's not like there's these giant warehouses full of ammo that they drop a bomb on. It's usually somebody's house or something like that.
Right, right. Yeah.
They'll say, well, we hit a military target and it was successful. But what it actually was a family sleeping in their beds.
It was bombing a neighborhood or a house in a residential area, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I saw this film called Born in Gaza. Very shocking, because it took you through what it was like for these six different children who were, you know, in their experience during the 2014 war, you know, with the bombing that was going on there. And it's just amazing the trauma that they have to go through just to survive. And then, you know, learning that some of their relatives were killed and everything. And I think most people don't understand. It's kind of like it's a chronic problem. It's over and over again.
Yeah.
There might be a couple of years between wars, but like you said, there's incursions by the IDF coming in and doing things, and there's drones overhead, and it seems like it's a very traumatic, intense place to live and grow up.
Yeah. And also, just to kind of flesh out the picture a little bit more, when thousands and thousands of homes and apartment buildings and businesses and factories are being bombed into rubble, and the blockade does not allow things like cement and nails and things to come in, you can't do a lot to repair your home. So people there's just no such thing as normalcy. You know, you
can. Yeah, well, yeah. How does that work? They bomb neighborhoods or homes, and now people have to go try to rebuild, but mm-hmm. you know, they can't get building supplies. I mean, you can't just go down to your local contract Home Depot and pick up supplies and right. hire a contractor who goes mm-hmm. and does that.
Palestinians have by necessity become very creative in their solutions. So they'll go to a site where a apartment building has been demolished, and they'll take all the concrete chunks and they'll grind it up, and try to create some new materials from that. They'll take the rebar out and straighten it out. And
they're doing
the best you can. So they're managing to manage, I guess, but it's not, there's never a normal day, I think.
I see. Okay. All right. Yeah. So all those things are controlled. I would also think that, you know, if they have hospitals, I've noticed that a lot of the hospitals, they must be sponsored by other organizations because they have other names. And so those people probably get permission to bring in materials and build a hospital. Does that sound right?
Yeah. Yeah. To a certain extent. And they'll get permission to bring in the machinery, the equipment mm-hmm. for x-rays and mammograms and all those different things. But then a lot of times, if there's repair that needs to be done on some of this equipment, Israel will say, well, no, we can't let the spare parts come in because you could use them for some nefarious purpose. There's a lot of compromise. Even before the war, there's a lot of compromise of the medical facilities and the equipment and even normal medications are hard to come by.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there's so many limitations and restrictions, and there's no guarantee. It sounds like we might be able to do this. We'll try, but and you just don't know. And just
ask and see what happens.
Right. Right. Okay. There's no. Yeah. It's hard to. You know. It's really hard. It's almost. It's pretty much impossible to build a business, an enterprise, to build an industry under those conditions, basically.
Yeah.
You have no free, it's not a free market where you can just freely engage in business transactions, mm-hmm. you know, and build an enterprise or whatever it is and start and have relationships with other businesses. It seems that it's so restrictive that mm-hmm. that's impossible to do that.
Yeah.
So what about since October 7th, let's pivot a little bit. October mm-hmm. 7th happens. What's the experience been like? They were in the refugee camp, and what was their experience from October 7th on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would get a text from Haria once in a while, and she would say, "Oh, there's bombing going on nearby, and we're all huddled together in one room." Or I would read about it on the news and I would say, "Hey, it looks like there's some bombing near you. Is everybody okay?" "Yes, we're okay." Electricity was turned off. So they have had literally no electricity since October 11th. I think that's the day
really? It was turned off. Wow.
No electricity. Solar panels. Some people have solar panels. So that's where you go if you want to get your cell phone charged mm-hmm. up. Go to somebody mm-hmm. who's got solar panels. Although for a while, Israel was specifically targeting solar panels on people's roofs.
Really?
Specifically doing that. Yeah. So no electricity. So, and then when they ran, you know, they've got their gas stove. And when the gas runs out, the cylinder is empty, you got no gas. So you collect wood and twigs and things from the neighborhood, and you make a fire to cook your food on that. And mm-hmm. so everybody's pantry had whatever canned goods and whatever. There's nothing in the fridge because you can't keep it cold. So everybody's going through whatever they got in the cabinets and eating the canned foods and whatever. And the little bits that they can find at, you know, at the stores, until that was all gone. or until it got to be so expensive that there was just no way that you could afford it. So it just kept going on and on and on. And how, you know, how long is this going to last? How much food can we eat today, not knowing how many more days this is going to last? So right. we had the family, they left their house. There was some bombing so close to the house that shrapnel came into their house. And they said, okay, we got to get out of this one. They went to an uncle's house, and a bunch of other families were there too. So they had something like 20 people, I think, in this small house. And mm-hmm. one night they opened a can of beans, and that's all that they had for the whole group. One can of beans. Everybody had like a spoonful of beans. They had flour that they had gotten from the UN for free. Every month, Haria told me, she said, every month we get a certain amount of flour, some oil, some sugar, a couple other things. And so they used that on, you know, they stretched it out as long as they could. And when there was no wheat left, they got some rice at the market, she said, although it was so expensive, but we had to have something to eat. Right. So they had rice. She said, it doesn't keep you full, but what other choices do you have?
So I would imagine the humanitarian aid from the UN, would have ended after October 7th. That aid couldn't get in after that, or was it possible?
I'm sure the family could answer that question for me, but when I asked it, I don't think I've posed it quite right, because I never got exactly straight answer. It sounds like they got some aid.
Continuing. Some aid, okay.
Like once every 3 months, they would get these items, flour and oil. And
Every 3 months. So
every
right.
3 months. Yeah. So I think they got flour since then. They got some flour, but I think the other items they weren't able to get.
Okay.
So they're eating what they can, what little they can. We've got growing kids there in fourth and fifth grade. We've got a lady who is 96 or 97 years old that they're trying to keep, you know, keep them from wasting away. This is what they're doing. They have no heat in the house. And when they ran out of sticks, or when they couldn't go outside for a while because it was too dangerous, I saw them ripping up books to put into the fire.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, just.
It's total survival mode.
Trying to
survive.
In our context, to do what they're doing would be like, a camping trip with the Boy Scouts, a survival trip with Boy Scouts, where you have to create your own fire and
it's amazing.
It's insane. Yeah.
So, what about school? Have schools completely shut down from October 7th? Everything is shut. There's no sense of normalcy then. October 7th.
Right. Yeah. So the kids have no school. Right. What my nephew explained to me, Musa, explained to me that the schools are no longer running as schools. The schools are now shelters for displaced people. Okay. And the stores, the shops are now shelters for displaced people. So everywhere you go, there's people just trying to cram in and find a safe, warm place to sleep. And that's all. I mean, it's just a survival thing, finding something to eat or someplace to sleep.
So what about like they've been very close to the bombing. They've been close to the conflict, very dangerous. Have they lost a lot of friends and other family? Do they know a lot of people who've been killed and wounded and so forth?
Yeah. So Haria's favorite professor at the university, who was also her advisor, was killed, and this was a huge blow to her. He was, she was very close to him. There've been a number of relatives that are close to them, not so close to us personally, but close to them. They've lost quite a few family members. I think in our clan, about 60 or 70 people have been killed. We've got a lot of the family is in Khan Yunis and Dera Beleh, and both of those have been under a lot of bombardment. So yeah, lots of loss. There are people that they've lost track of. Musa has some good friends who they're not answering their phones anymore. They're not answering texts, and you just don't know.
So you don't know. They, you know, chances are they could have died. They could have been killed, but you just don't know.
You don't know. You just hope, well, maybe they lost their phone or it got smashed.
Yeah.
And now you probably heard that a lot of journalists have been killed. Well over 100 Palestinian journalists have been killed in Gaza. It seems that they are being targeted.
Oh, really?
On purpose. Okay. Yeah. And so there are not that many journalists to go around anymore. So what Musa is telling me is that now houses are being bombed and people are being killed and there's nobody to report on it. So nobody knows.
So no one knows the details of what's going on.
Right.
Yeah, because I remember early on, I would hear some on social media or something. I'd get some reporting from Palestinian journalists, but we haven't heard that much recently.
There's not that many left.
Yeah, that's amazing. But it's just the witnesses that will be able to report what they've heard, but not that can't happen until there's stability, right?
Well, and also they're not just targeting a journalist, they're also targeting the families of journalists.
Oh.
So if you're a journalist and you're seeing families being killed of your cohort, maybe you won't report anymore just to protect your family. I guess this is the thinking on the part of Israel.
I think that what this is telling us is that Israel is not only controlling all these other things, but they're controlling the narrative.
Yes.
They're trying to control everything. So because they have their version of what's happening, mm-hmm. and any other version inside Palestine, inside Gaza, they want to suppress it.
Right.
They don't want it to come out.
And Israel is refusing to let foreign journalists go into Gaza. Like you can't see it from the inside. You're just going to have to trust what we tell you.
Right.
I remember censoring the news.
Yes. People go to the border and they report from the border, but that's all they can do. They can't go in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So they have lost some family and friends. So it's so sad that they, it's very personal to them. Thankfully, no one in your immediate family has died, though. Is that correct?
So far, yes.
Right. Yeah. So, but it's very personal, very close, it sounds like they've been driven to at least one. How many places have they lived since October 7th? Have they been driven more than once? And where do they live now?
I think it took them a couple of days to get to Khan Yunis. They had to stay in, I'm not sure where they stayed along the way. But they've been there for a few days. Like a week and a half now. They've built, they got some fabric somewhere and kind of built a little tent next to the house because there's so many people there now that they just, created a little bit more space for people to sleep, sort of. I think a couple of meters square that's protected a little bit from the elements.
Right. So it sounds like they moved within the refugee camp. They had to move at least once.
Right. Yeah.
And then they moved from the refugee camp to this other sheltering place or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're hoping that they don't have to move again, but they're kind of afraid that they probably will because a lot of people are actually starting to leave Khan Yunis and go even farther south to Rafah. But there's
and how far is Khan Yunis from Rafah, which is the border town, right?
Right.
Border with Egypt.
Yeah, it might be 8 or 10 miles or something like that. There's a million people there. You can barely walk around in Rafah.
Yeah. So the question is, where would they go if they had to leave?
They have no relatives there. So, yeah, they would have to show up and try to find a corner somewhere to sit. Right. But the crowding is not just a problem in terms of, you know, privacy and are there enough bathrooms for everyone and is there enough food? It's also, it's a petri dish for all of the diseases that are starting to spread.
Oh, right.
You know, there's a lot of disease going around and that's going to, they're saying that's going to kill more people than the bombs. Ultimately.
No, that's what happens. I worked in refugee camps in Africa. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the thing that happens. There's a progression of, you get a whole mass of people in one place and things are, there's no stability. There's no clean water. There's no, you know, all these basic fundamental things that we have to survive aren't in place yet. And then you're going to get diseases. Mm-hmm. And so now it's just for them, it's just everything's being destroyed worse and worse. And now if you get sick, where do you go? Are there any hospitals still open? I mean,
there are hospitals that have doors that you can go inside, if that's how you define an open hospital, but they have no supplies, really.
They don't have it.
So, and the wounded from the bombings are kind of first priority. Although I don't know if you've heard this, but there's so little in terms of painkillers and anesthesia that people are actually, including children, are having amputations without anesthesia.
Oh my. We're going back to the Civil War days and pre-Civil War.
it's like I can't even wrap my brain around that.
No, you
how
can't.
Do you it's do just, that?
How do you do that? Right. No, that's crazy.
And the answer is you do that because there's no other choice. And
there's no other choice, right.
That's
either try to save their life or they bleed out, right?
Yeah.
That's just it's horrific.
It is.
So, we talked a little bit about how much aid is getting in. People are very unsure of the future. They don't know what's going to happen, right? What is their outlook? What have they been told on the ground might happen? When is the war going to end, etc.?
I don't think there's any official communication, anybody saying, you know, hang in there 2 more weeks because this is going to be over or anything. Mm-hmm. Everybody's kind of assuming it's going to be indefinite. I mean, Israel is saying this is going to be a very, very long war. Hopefully that's not the case, but I don't think they have any expectations for it to end anytime soon. So I asked Musa, what do you think about the future? And this is what he told me. He said, all the people here want to find a safe place and a promising future, especially the young people. They want to leave and immigrate. The young people here are dreamers, but nothing here meets their ambitions. The savings that they have that they wanted to use to get married or to build a house with, they had to use it for canned goods and vegetables.
Right.
So that's what the future looks like. It looks like I've got no money. I will have no money. I'll have no house. I want to get out of here if I possibly can. But right now, it costs at least $10,000 for a person to basically bribe Egyptian officials to let them out.
Mm-hmm.
And then take it from there. So
there is talk of, you know, that Israel wants to displace everyone into the Sinai Peninsula, into Egypt. What is the thought on the ground about that, and what have they heard?
So it's been this has been going on for 3 months now, right? And it's been several weeks now, at least 5 or 6 weeks, I want to say, that people have been saying this is another Nakba. And when they first started to say it, everybody is like, I mean, that's like the Holocaust. You can't use the word Nakba. That's a sacred word, the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948. Mm-hmm. You only reserve that for a real catastrophe. So don't use the word Nakba.
Right.
But it is a Nakba. And the people that lived through the Nakba are saying this is worse. This is way worse than the first one.
Yeah.
And what was the question? Oh, the question was about Sinai.
There's talk that, it, you know, yeah, I mean, so, at least the U.S. is saying, no, you can't do that. And other allies of Israel are trying to, it looks like they're trying to stop Israel from some of these more nefarious plans. And one of them is to drive them all into Egypt and just get rid of them out of the territories completely.
Oh, there's way more nefarious than that. They've been talking, or they say they haven't been talking, but they've been talking to the Congo, to Rwanda, and to Chad to see if they would take some.
Yeah, I read that, and I almost couldn't believe that. Really, I mean,
oh.
Oh, we'll solve the problem. We'll ship you to Africa. So,
I mean, people, this is why they're calling it, Israel's calling it a humanitarian, voluntary transfer, because I've got nothing left to go back to. I'm starving. I'm dying. There are bombs dropping on me. Yes, get me out. I'll go into the desert.
But why are they in that condition? Because of what Israel is doing.
That's not voluntary transfer. And forced transfer is a crime against humanity. So we're talking about not just another Nakba, as if that's not enough. We're talking about crime against freaking humanity again. Mm-hmm. In addition to all of the other war crimes and the other crimes that are going on, which sounds like a good segue into talking about the genocide accusation.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah. So a couple of days ago, South Africa filed with the International Court of Justice saying, we want Israel to be tried for genocide. Just that simple. They submitted, I think, an 84-page document detailing why the accusation of genocide is reasonable. Dozens and dozens of quotes by the prime minister, by the president, by ministers, top ministers in Israel, saying things that are genocidal. Literally saying, we've got to get rid of them. Everybody in Gaza is a part of Hamas, and we have to get rid of Hamas. Genocidal statements. The actions that Israel is taking in Gaza, where they're not allowing humanitarian aid to come in. They're not allowing medical supplies to come in. They are bombing and destroying hospitals. They're bombing and destroying food warehouses. They're dropping bombs on convoys of humanitarian aid. They're doing all of these things that indicate that they're trying to kill off the population. So this is the allegation, and it's very well documented.
It's coming from the South African government?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
It's very well documented. Everything that's been going on has been happening right out in the open, because in the 21st century, there's only so much you can hide. So, that's out there. And today's what, the 10th? Tomorrow and Friday, they're having opening hearings, or whatever it's called, in the International Court of Justice.
Okay. All right.
That's for genocide. Israel is saying, oh, no, that's preposterous. The United States is saying, oh, we haven't seen anything that would indicate genocide. Are you kidding me?
Really?
So,
it's amazing how the U.S. is supplying Israel with the bombs, and you know, you've read that they're using very large bombs. They're not using small bombs that would be targeting. A lot of times it's 2,000-pound bombs, et cetera. Yeah. And you hear a little bit of pushback every once in a while, but it's just there's no teeth to it at all. So Israel can really do what they want.
So weak. We're the most powerful country in the world, and we hold the keys.
Yeah, to because Israel. We provide them with the military
so
aid.
Much money.
Right.
Yeah. And all we're doing is saying, gee, Bibi, maybe you could try a little harder to avoid women and children.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, we are, and Israel has said we are operating within international law. It's just so impossible. They're just lying through their teeth.
Yeah.
It's just all lies. Yeah.
Right.
So what we've got going on is a genocide, and that's not hyperbole, and that's not anti-Semitism. That is a fact. We are seeing genocide. It's being live streamed onto our TVs and our phones, and ethnic cleansing besides. This is just stunning that this is going on now when we say we are we're a democracy and we are, you know, people with compassion, and we love all people and things like we have to, I mean, every person who knows what's going on needs to raise their voices. We need to.
Let's end on that. I mean, what can we do? I know, you know, you blog a lot. You've got a lot of articles out there that I encourage everyone to listen on your Pathos blog. I'll put it in the show notes. Got a great story to tell there. There's been also, you've put in information about how to contact your congressmen or women, and, you know, even the president, I think. But, you know, some of us have done that. You know, you've written letters. You might call your congressman. Nothing seems to work. I mean, I haven't got a reply from the people that I've contacted. Even though they say, oh, do you want to hear back from us? Oh, yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. No. So,
yeah.
But so, there is a movement. There is a movement.
There is.
Even from the Israel side, Jewish Voices for Peace and other organizations that are saying, this is insane. Let's have a ceasefire. Let's stop this. And let's, you know, get to the root of the problem instead of solving it with this military solution. Mm-hmm. But what is happening, and what can we do?
Yeah. So, well, first of all, we can write to our congressman and the president every day. And just keep those letters coming, because even though we think they're ignoring them, they have to keep a tally of how many people are supporting Israel, how many people are supporting the Palestinian cause. And they will be answerable to it at some point. So I just keep a tab open on my laptop, and every day I send them a message, just ceasefire, you know, justice for Palestine. It doesn't even matter that much what you say, just that they're getting it, that it's coming. So that's one thing. Another thing that we can do is definitely so important is to inform other people. And, you know, there are a lot of people that watch mainstream media, and mainstream media is bought and paid for by the Israel lobby. They are not telling the whole story. They're not telling the truth. There's a lot of information coming out about the bias within mainstream media. I think I posted something on If Americans Knew just yesterday about there. You can count it. And I've done media studies like this myself. You can find out how many times the words Israel and like massacre or terrorists, or there's different, you can do word searches and find out. And what basically has been discovered, like it's a big surprise or something, is that when Palestinian victims are talked about, they died. Okay. Or they, there was a loss of this number of people. Mm-hmm. They won't talk about Palestinians as women and children. They won't talk about them as people, like the wife of or the grandfather of. But when you're talking about Israeli victims, they are humanized. You know, this is, he was, had four kids and
right.
this and that.
Right.
I mean, there's all kinds of studies out about how mainstream media dehumanizes Palestinians. So
And if you just keep your ears open, you can hear it. It's mm-hmm. it's so obvious. Oftentimes.
Yeah.
But it and this is really good information. Encouraging people to really get knowledge, speak up, contact your political representatives more than just once, over and over again, because the message has to get through. And it there's a huge narrative, that a counter narrative, that is really hard to get to circumvent. I mean,
yeah.
When I've spoken up, a lot of times you get pushback from people that believe in this other narrative mm-hmm. and don't understand the context of how this whole conflict has played out over decades, right?
Right.
And so the Israeli narrative is very strong. So I encourage people to not only listen to people like yourself and anyone like myself who blogs about it, but mm-hmm. the real experts, some of the people who really know what they're talking about, like Chris Hedges.
Right.
He's a war correspondent, worked in Gaza for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years or something. Mm-hmm. Really knows. He was some kind of a director of Middle East media for New York Times or something like that. He knows what's going on. And those are the people who are telling the truth. Or Israeli mm-hmm. historian Ilan Pape, Jewish political scientist, Norm Finkelstein.
Oh, gosh,
these are some of the folks that I've been getting some resources from, mm-hmm. even Jewish Voices for Peace, Combatants for Peace is another Jewish organization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What are the sources that you recommend people go to?
Oh, definitely Al Jazeera News is, I mean, you can't even recognize that CNN is reporting on the same war that Al Jazeera is, because Al Jazeera actually has, of the few that are still alive, has reporters in Gaza, you know, actual Palestinian reporters who talk to Al Jazeera and tell Al Jazeera what's going on, and Al Jazeera reports it.
Right.
I mean, you don't hear on mainstream media, you rarely hear from a Palestinian guest, you know, mm-hmm. being interviewed. You don't hear the other side of the story. So Al Jazeera, hands down, does a great job.
Okay.
If Americans knew, if I do say so myself, we do a fair job of keeping up with what's going on. Democracy Now! Always has excellent coverage, and they always talk to the guys on the other side. They're always talking with Palestinians as well as Israelis. And then my new favorite to watch on YouTube is Breaking Points. Breaking Points for news. So those are good places to go. And
I'll put all those in the show notes. We'll get them all listed there for people to check out. That's great. Mm-hmm.
I just want to say it again, because I mean, I live kind of in a bubble of people who understand the situation in Palestine. All of the people who hang with me on Facebook and whatever are people who know about this, but a great deal of people in America have no idea what's going on. So it really behooves us as people who are informed to start informing other people, because this is not going to end or change until we have a bigger grassroots movement going, just of people just saying, stop it, stop, stop it. So right. we just need to talk about it. Everybody, I mean, I mean, as a person of faith, especially, why would we not talk about genocide going on right now? Why would we not talk about that?
Some people just can't. They don't want to believe it. They want to believe the other narrative, and they don't want to believe it because if you do start to believe it, you have to start saying, "Oh, well, heck! If it's genocide, then our country is supporting Israel. And if it's genocide, I've been supporting Israel for decades or whatever." You know,
that can't be right.
Right. So it can't be right. So it really is an existential crisis for some people to kind of bridge that gap and go, "Wow, you know." And then that's what it's hard to. But you're right. We have to continually tell the truth, have good sources, and expose any of the dehumanization that's going on, or the prejudice, or the discrimination, and the warping of the media. So, thank you, Kathy, so much for being on. Anything else you want to share?
I have just a couple of little things I want to throw out there. Most of the media kind of frames the conflict as the Israel-Hamas war, because Israel claims it's fighting against Hamas, but it's not the Israel-Hamas war. This is a war, I don't think war is even the fair word to use. It's between Israel and Gaza, or Israel and the Palestinians, because as you know, in the West Bank, things are really in bad shape too. It's a war between Israel and the Palestinian people. Hamas is just part of it. It's like saying, well, this is a war between the IDF and Hamas. No, this is a war between Israel, which is one of the great military powers in the entire world, and the people of Gaza, who have a small group of resistance fighters with a small amount of weaponry and things. That's what this is. And I also want to say, we need to stop calling Hamas a terrorist organization.
Why is that?
Well, because for one thing, it demonizes the whole of Hamas, which, as you know, is also civic and political. And it does have a military wing. And that military wing has done some pretty horrendous things. October 7th included some pretty horrendous things. But that's not what Hamas is. That's not Hamas. That is some Hamas resistance fighters who might have gone overboard. To say Hamas is a terrorist organization, but Israel is not, it's not fair.
Not to reality. Palestinian. Right.
If somebody wants to say Israel or the Israel military is a terrorist organization, okay, then I'm willing to talk about Hamas being a terrorist organization too. But I haven't found anybody who is willing to say that.
Right. It's amazing how the terms that we use can really frame and cloud over what's really going on, right? So, okay, that's very interesting and very good points there. Thank you so much, Kathy. We're going to put all this information in the show notes, folks, so that you have some resources, how to contact your Congress representatives, the president, how to get some better information from sources that who really know and have experienced what's going on. How to overcome some of the media bias and so forth. So we hope you take advantage of that and put into practice what some of the things that Kathy's been suggesting. And so thank you, Kathy, again. I really so sad about your family. We hope and pray for the best for them, and hope that this will end one day for them. But right now it's looking really bleak, and we just stand with you and your family.
If any of your listeners want to kind of follow along with what's going on with the family, I'm blogging about it on my Patheos blog so they can
find right. We'll put that in the show notes too. You can follow along with what's going on. All right. Well, we've run out of time. Thanks, Kathy. We'll be in touch and with you and see how things are progressing and so forth. But folks, take advantage of all this information. And until next time, enjoy responsibly.